as of 2023, over 1,500 institutions that control $40 trillion in assets have committed to divesting from fossil fuels, but still more action is needed to mobilize institutions of higher education, faith communities, unions, and local state and governments to divest from fossil fuels and other extractive industries and institutions that target Indigenous communities for exploitation and the fuel crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous people. The moral and political imperatives to reinvest in Indigenous communities hardest hit by extraction, exploitation, colonial violence, and a lot of this comes from law enforcement and man camps, sea level rise, extreme weather, and other manifestations of climate catastrophe really do merit far more attention and action. How are our various institutions implicated in exploitation of Indigenous lands and people and the exclusion of Indigenous people from equitable health outcomes, education, and investments, as well as access to traditional first foods? How do we document, make visible, and address these harms? How do we expand, build, and maintain coalitions to divest from fossil fuels and other extractive industries, institutions, and reinvest in those very Indigenous communities and try to repair the violence inherent in settler colonialism? What traditional and contemporary models of grassroots action, activism, organization, and coalition building can we draw from? As a land-grant institution, we recognize that the Morrell Act of 1862 established land-grant institutions by providing each state with public and federal lands, which are traced back to the dispossession of Indigenous lands. In 1890, Washington State received 90,000 acres of Indigenous lands designated to establish Washington State University. Washington State University still maintains and retains the majority of these lands to this day, something around 70,000 acres. We acknowledge that the dispossession of Indigenous lands was taken by coercive and violent acts, as well as the disregard of treaties. For that, we extend our deepest apologies. We owe our deepest gratitude to Native peoples of this region and maintain our commitment towards reconciliation. Katsiao Yao, thank you. So please give a welcome to Robin White. Thank you, Katsiao Yao.
Climate collapse is upon us. We already know the causes. We also know that we have a lot less time than the original estimates gave us to heal this situation. And that's a very frightening thing for everyone. And we need to move this up on our list as we do other things and really realize how it affects every other part of our lives. We know that Indigenous people are the most affected by this. The colonial and corporatocracy. Colonialism has been through corporations forever, whether it's the fur trade or the mining trade or trade in general has always been corporations backed up by governments, backed up by the church, and backed up by military and police. That hasn't changed any. That continues to be the same, particularly in the realm of fossil fuels. We can become allies in this, and we need to talk about that those alliances and particularly with Native peoples, how those alliances work, how they need to work. We have these entrenched vestiges of colonialism in all aspects of government and institutions, in particular the land-grant university system. Today, we hope to examine the university's culpability in that fact and the fact that it still owns 80% of its original land from that land grant, and that they're making at least $4.5 million a year off of that just at WSU. The land was taken from tribes like the Chinook and the Duwamish that still fight for a seat at the council fires at the table. You know, we need to look at how the institutions and systems continue to shut out Native voices and pit tribe against tribe in fights over scraps. We want to look at reparations and how they may be a direct answer to climate collapse and to the grip of the corporatocracy. You know, in order to stop climate collapse, in time to save us, we still need to get the money out of the fossil fuel industry. We need to reinvest that money in solutions that are good for labor and good for the community. We also need to talk about the snake oil salesman and the resurgence of the tumor of the nuke industry. We're going to be talking today a lot about the salmon scam and the Bolt decision and how incredibly important they've been, not only to Native peoples, but directly to the saving of the environment with treaty and sovereignty rights and the enforcement of those rights through the legal system and through the courts. Why don't we start with Mr. Robert Collin?
Indigenous people safeguard 80% of the global biodiversity. The medicines that are there, the species we haven't even looked at that may go, despite being less than 5% of the global population, because of the traditional knowledge of ancestors. Discussion here on this conference at 12:45 talks about decolonizing academia. In Africa, Chad, Burkina Faso, Benin, and Niger all developed, indigenous people there, all developed at laws and national documents submitted to UN bodies. And guess who facilitated that? The largest indigenous person group in the world is in Africa. 135 indigenous peoples in 21 countries worked together and they helped each other. So there's real power and people joining other indigenous people, and we need that. The burden of climate change, but also the burden of mitigation is on those being hit the hardest, those that live the shortest lives, so that those that have the worst health. Internationally, indigenous people's rights have been violated all over the world. Land grabbing, that's a nice word for occasional murder. Forced displacement, destruction and contamination of land, destruction and contamination of water with uranium. That lasts probably, I would say 800 or 900 generations at least before it doesn't start killing you with weird cancers. So the destruction of ancient sites and places, the exclusion of this planet-saving group results in programs and ambitions and aspirations that are short-term focused, lack the buy-in to be real, and threaten long-term resilience of everyone.
Kent Ford?
I did some work still doing work with the Black Panther Party and came into the party in 1969 via the peace movement, not the civil rights movement. And then, of course, you know, things evolved over the years. I was first to talk about the islands and Pacific Islands, Polynesian Islands. The party made alliances in all these islands, and including the Appalachian Mountains, working with the whites in Appalachia. That's because of Chairman Fred Hampton. You know, we're going to cross over racial solidarity, multiracial, multicultural, multiethical. We're going to cure racism with solidarity. And I've seen a lot come together since post-George Floyd, actually. The struggle and the movement has accomplished more since post-George Floyd than civil rights accomplished in over 50 years. And why did I say that? Yeah, someone mentioned agriculture and the environment and all that. Well, there was a lady right here in Portland. She had a little agriculture thing where she distributed food in the neighborhood and everything. The state agriculture department showed up to her place, gave her a grant, and told her to apply for a USDA grant. Within 3 months, she had all this money that she hardly knew what to do with. And I met her on one of my walking tours. She came up and explained it to me. I began to put all that together, you know. I said, oh, this is because of post-George Floyd. Ever since they've been tracking these police murders during the Obama administration in 2015, every year you can go to the Washington Post, the great lady in New York, the New York Times, and you can go to any of these guys, 1,000, 1,100, 1,200 people being dusted by the police every year. in a monument in a whole European Union just last year. Only 10 people got dusted by the police. And we had a 10-point platform and program, land, bread, housing, that related to the struggle of indigenous people in the world. Number 7, we want to be the end of police brutality and murder of Black people. That's more valid today than was written back in by a group of Mary College students back in 1966. We fed over 30,000 kids a week nationwide. Had seen over 100 patients a week at the health clinics and dental clinics. Come to us, tell us what's going on. We'll be right there with you to try to fix it, fix the problem, whatever it was.
Kathy Sampson-Cruz.
Hi, Katsiyaya. Sheikh Haskumpa, good morning. I want to have a big thank you, a big warm hug to everyone who is speaking and to all those who are listening. You are the ones who can create change. You are the ones who can turn your voice into action. Your great-grandchildren will remember the pain and destruction that has been brought on by the bazillionaire class, the corporate bullies, the alternative universe of lies and deceit that has been told over 500 years. Those lies and deceit have consequences. We, the people, take that historical trauma and that endured pain, and we rose to action. We demand accountability and justice and unity that can move the compass of moral obligation to do something. You are the ones whose great-grandchildren will tell stories to their children about the struggle, the movement, and the revolution of change that happened. We have the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians that many of you have elected members, or you can join as individuals or allies. And I have met a wonderful group of people in the Northwest that are willing to lay their bodies on the line to make their voices and their actions happen. One of those people that I met is an amazing woman. It's probably been 10 years now. She's with the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, and her name is Lauren Reagan. If you don't know about cldc.org, look it up. Donate what you can, because her organization has represented thousands of people who have resisted and have stood up for the moral compass against what we are now looking at, green colonialism. How do we take those people's ancestors, elders, beloved ones' words and keep them so close to our heart and be able to stand up, rise up, and make peace with nature in this current economic, global foreshadowing of a disaster that is coming for our grandchildren? It brings me back to my young days, you know, whether it was, marching against Vietnam or at Portland State on, you know, apartheid, or back at NYC not that long ago, staying with Code Pink people in Harlem. When you see those big groups of people that want change, and then on the same hand we have leaders in the environmental movement that are truly selling us out. And yes, I'm going to name them: Jim Hansen, Bill McKibben. You know, then we have gazillionaires like Bezos and Gates trying to invest in small modular nuclear reactors and deploy them across the continent. You know, there's this shake my head time that we have to regroup before that kind of green sellout continues to happen. The land, the air, and the water. We cannot forget that Tumen, in our heart, we have to do better.
Kuhayam, Rachel Kushmaneka Yachun, Naika Tulakum, Insika Chinookin Nation, Insika Klatsat, Kahlamet, Wakayakum, Wulupa, Pilor Chinook. Hello, my name is Rachel Cushman. I am, as Robin has said, a hereditary and elected leader of the Chinook Indian Nation. We are the five most Western Chinookin speaking tribes at the mouth of the Columbia River. We are in both Oregon and Washington. On the Oregon side, we are Clatsop and Kathlamet. On the Washington side, we are Kaikum, Willapa, and Lower Chinook. And I've been working to protect Indigenous rights, land, and sovereignty for over 20 years. I was raised to do this work. That's what my family brought me into this world to do, and have had me training with elders, traditional ecological knowledge keepers, allies since I was a child. I am a scholar. I've written quite a bit about resurgence of Indigenous lifeways on the landscape. I have written about pigmentocracy. I've written about different ways of teaching. I've helped develop curriculum. I am a PhD student at the University of Oregon, working on a degree in Indigenous race and ethnic studies. The focus of my work is on recognition politics, particularly, and that's because of the community that I come from and the work that we're doing. I'm also a 2022 Indian Collective Changemaker Fellow, where I am working with other Indigenous leaders throughout the Western Hemisphere to defend, develop, and decolonize the landscape. I actually just wrote a paper and submitted it to a publisher a couple weeks ago. It's called We Demand Respect, Practicing Radical Sovereignty and Unsettling Environmentalism. For those that don't know, the Chinook Indian Nation is a community facing slow motion genocide. We've been fighting since 1851 for our rights. We've signed treaties at the negotiation table with the United States government, that those treaties went back east and were tabled indefinitely. And we filed our first lawsuit against the federal government in 1899. We won that lawsuit. We won multiple other acts of the Supreme Court as well as Congress over the decades, but we live in a legal limbo area. We've been actively fighting for our rights my whole life. So this is what I was born into, a fight for justice. And I could talk more about that, but it would take the whole time to talk about Chinook justice. There is a website, chinookjustice.org, if you're interested in learning more specifically about our fight for federal acknowledgement. Sovereignty is not based on federal acknowledgement. Sovereignty comes from the land. It comes from the ancestors, from the people. It cannot be bestowed upon a nation. We are a sovereign nation regardless of our acknowledgement, and we practice that sovereignty.